David stepped away. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Limark Technical Net. And, everyone's welcome to join in if you have some questions or topics. We still have a little bit free time, and so if anyone out there has any questions or topics, please hit that push talk the button and give me your first name and your call sign.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George.
Yeah, real quick, yes or no, did you go to Windows 11? Don't give me any details, but did you go to it yet?
Yes, I have. I have three computers. Two out of the three computers was able to tolerate it. One computer hasn't been able to swallow it, so I've given it a little bit more time. I'm not terribly, it's not great. It's okay. I have no particular problems with it, and I get the feeling you don't want details anyway.
Hey, thanks. Great answer. KD2FIU. Thank you, Roy.
You're welcome, George. Anytime. Anyway, once again, this is AC2GS. If anyone out there has any questions or topics that they would like to discuss tonight, we still have a little bit more time, so please, if you do, hit that push-to-talk button and give us your topic.
WB2BXO, Roy.
Yes, Frank.
Okay. I actually got in when the repeater let echo link in and before anyone else pushed the button again. Okay. Just wondering if you saw the 60-minute segment on Havana syndrome. And you've probably heard before the theory that it's high energy microwave device of some sort. I think the last time we talked about the topic on TechNet, the thinking was that it was psychosomatic, and I'm wondering if that's still the thinking or whether you and some of the other guys here have some other thoughts on it now that a little more seems to be known about it, at least in the public domain. Go ahead, Vern.
Okay, I'm a little confused. I don't really watch 60 Minutes these days because they're not quite the same as they once were long ago. A couple years ago, Dick was still alive because he had listened to a similar broadcast from 60 Minutes and we discussed it. And I tended to take the side of the psychosomatic. There's a lot of very well documented mass delusions, things going historically, and so far it had the tone of that. Is this a new 60 Minutes broadcast on the same subject? Because it sounds very, very similar to the one that they aired 2 years ago.
I saw it. WB2EAZ is new.
KD2FIU, I heard something on CBS AM radio the other day about it.
No, I saw it. I was just reporting that.
So, okay, very good. So I guess I'll ask you, Ed. I know that the CIA, and we all trust the CIA, recently released a report that basically says that they haven't been able to find anything, solid evidence for any actual weapon or device, and their best answer was psychosomatic. But again, a lot of people don't really trust the CIA. Ed, can you give me a short version of what 60 Minutes reported on today?
Yes, they interviewed quite a few people, a number of people in great detail about what happened to them, and they all have very similar stories. And then they interviewed the current director of the CIA, Burns. He was with the State Department for many years, and then about a year ago, he was put into head the CIA, and they said they are taking it absolutely seriously now. The CIA director said, personally, one of his staff became a victim of it, and they are absolutely sure that it is real now. And actually, they said it was an embarrassment that for so long, such serious people had similar stories that they didn't even know about that were being rejected. And they're looking into it now, and they're saying the primary culprit they're looking into, which brings up a lot of questions to me, is high-energy microwaves. Now, as Dick K2RIW was new, they have had a lot of experience with people being exposed to high-power microwaves with radar antennas, microwave towers, and what they found was the only physiological effects that they were finding had to do with the heating of the liquids in the eyeball were leading to early cataracts and the like, but they couldn't find anything else. Of course, they were not going to ask people to sit there and volunteer. They had to go by, you know, what they had through, you know, accidents or stuff like that. But it also brings up a thing of then you get into power density, power, you know, focusing the beam, aiming a focus beam and all that, which they did not address at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of the same conversation we had 2 years ago. In order, I think these the original reports of the microwave effects are based on things like really radar dishes. You're talking heavy-duty power output. And supposedly, people were able to drag that through the Cuban streets and secretly projected at people. It just has way too much of a geographically diffuse history. And the technology, unless no one knows about modern technology, is probably not that agile. So I'm continuing to think that there's a lot of politics being played back and forth about all this. And I'm still not quite sure that it's not psychosomatic. People kind of don't get a happy feeling when you tell them they're having psychosomatic problems, because unfortunately, especially government-type people think that translates into they're going crazy. They're not going crazy. People do have these hallucinations, these delusions, these kind of built-up stories. Back in the 1990s, I don't know if you tuned in, but there was this whole bunch of people molesting preschool children, where they found out eventually that none of it existed, that their analysts, their therapists kind of talked them into these false memories. So I think it's still unknown. We'll see what happens. Hopefully over time someone will come up with the ultimate answer.
Comment, Roy?
Yeah, sure. You always can have a comment, Ed.
They're saying some of the victims are having long-term problems with actual, you know, quantifiable medical effects. So that doesn't exactly line up what you're saying. Also, apparently people who are interviewed, you know, right up front gave very, very similar stories when they hadn't heard the other interviews, so they didn't exactly know what symptoms to report, and there was a tremendous commonality in symptoms that were reported.
Okay, I mean, we'll see what happens. You know, I mean, I don't know what to tell you. A lot of times, people, especially if these guys have heard stories before of other people, when they have their weird feelings, you know, it doesn't take a lot of memory juggling to kind of superimpose that. It's the reason why UFOs all look like saucers, because back when they first had the first fake UFO, actually it was cigar-shaped, but the reporter mislabeled it as saucer, and ever since then, everyone who ever sees a UFO apparently tends to see saucers. So, I don't know. And there's a lot of people with vague complaints or illnesses, autoimmune disorders, infections, all kinds of things, where it takes 20 years for even doctors to be able to figure out what it is, because our tests aren't always sensitive for that. And, you know, there are people out there who believe they're allergic to radio waves and they want to move down to Virginia. That's an RF-free zone. So, you know, people are curious.
Virginia, an RF-free zone? Did I ever tell you my theory about UFOs? I'll bet you never heard it if it wasn't for me.
Okay, I'm game. Well, isn't there an area in Virginia that does a lot of RF sweeping or something, and so there's no cell phones in some little area, someplace down there?
Well, any highly rural area will do that. Because, you know, the area in Virginia near Washington, D.C. is like a hotbed. That's where the CIA is, the NSA, all of these agencies, all of the satellite monitoring stuff. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of stuff in northern Virginia. Yeah, you get out to western Virginia, out in the boondocks, yeah. But that'd be true in Nebraska, South Dakota, you know. All right, here's my theory. Let me drop it.
WS2N. I think Brian's talking about Greenbank, West Virginia area. What they got, like 50 square kilometers. It's a quiet zone. You know, it's because of the radio astronomy that goes on there. But there's no transmitters whatsoever allowed in that area. Back to you.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George recognized, Ed recognized, I just wanted to mention it. It's called the National Radio Quiet Zone. It encompasses apparently 13,000 square miles near the border between Virginia and West Virginia. And there really are people out there who think they're allergic to RF who want to move to places like that.
Sounds wonderful, but what do you do for a living there if you're not an astronomer?
I don't know, grow potatoes?
All right, UFO story?
Yeah, I just want to see, George, did you want to make a quick comment?
Yeah, and the phone is ringing over here. And by the way, that area of Virginia on the West Virginia border is further away from Washington, D.C. than we are. Just a light comment.
Okay, very good. So, Ed, tell me the UFO thing.
Now, when and where did all these start? Like 1947, 1948, Area 51 was out in the southwestern desert, right, Roy?
Yes, it all started apparently with a weather balloon.
Remember hearing about when Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier in the Belt X-1? Do you remember when Mel App bought the farm in the Belt X-2? Do you remember when a lot of other test pilots were flying hot and fancy these new jet and rocket planes like the F-104 missile with a man in it? Where were they testing all of these and when?
Nearby, you're going to tell me that Area 51 was really a skunk works. I've heard that.
Ed, I thought it was Nevada.
Yeah, exactly. Edwards Air Force Base. Here's my point. Imagine you're an Air Force intelligence officer, and you're worried people are going to start seeing all kinds of stuff. So what do you do? You start spreading the most ridiculous stories about space aliens and unidentified flying objects you can think of. So that when somebody saw Mel App crash in the X-2 and starts talking about it, they say, oh, another UFO story.
Well, yeah, I agree with you entirely. I think there's a big component to that. I mean, that's why the Air Force had Operation Blue Book.
Well, I I think it's a variation on the same theme, and I think we're in total agreement.
Yeah, yeah, but it's interesting to actually see, because they didn't kind of birth it full form. They just gave people hints, and other people connected the dots. And you could actually track back where some guy talked about a cigar-shaped vehicle, and then the reporter completely misunderstood and wrote saucer, and for the next 20 years, people were showing up at the nighttime radio stations to say that they were beamed up to this saucer-shaped device, and they were probed in all kinds of curious places.
I have a comment.
Sure. What's your comment, Ed?
A month or two ago, there was a big deal about airplane radar altimeters and 5G telephones interfering. I read a couple of items in the news in very prestigious news organizations, and it was obvious that they assigned somebody who knew as much about the subject as I know about, earthworms. And it showed that I was reading these articles and I found the most grievous technical errors. And I have always noticed, when I've heard there's something in the newspaper that I really, really, really understand, I see where they get so much wrong. So why should this be an exception?
Well, you know, I mean, that's the truth. Look, human beings are fallible. Newspapers more so. Also, newspapers do not pay people to be on salary who know everything. At best, curious, aggressive people who ask questions when they're in the mood. So it's not uncommon, as far as I'm concerned, that stuff you read in the newspaper you should take with a grain of salt. I remember a long, long time ago in the New York Times, there was an article about how dare AMD try to challenge Intel's position in the chip technology sphere. And I pointed it out to someone, and they said, well, it's in the newspaper. It's got to be true. So that was the first time that AMD cleaned Intel's clock. Nowadays, they're cleaning their clock again. So you got to take everything with a grain of salt. I mean, I used to tell Dick that you need a good BS meter to succeed in life, because even the New York Times gets it wrong. No one's infallible. You know, I won't bring up religion that some guy sits in a magic chair and becomes infallible, but I don't know of anyone who actually owns that kind of a chair.
KD2FRU.
Yes, George.
I will say this. It doesn't matter whether it's the New York Times, or I don't even know if the Daily News is still around, or the New York Post, or whether it's information on the Internet. Every day you will get something wrong, and you will get something right. And it's up to us, individuals, to put it all together, because none of them are correct every day, and this is what I've learned all my life.
Okay, but the problem is there's a lot of guys out there legitimately busy with their own lives, taking care of their family, making a living. They don't have time to check stuff, so unfortunately they tend to fall into bubbles. And they believe those particular bubbles. Again, human nature. We have a little bit extra time. We can look around. We can figure things out. But a lot of people don't have that luxury, unfortunately, or the critical thinking skills, because the school system didn't really teach them that.
I have an alternate.
KD2FRU, I want to say this. Legacy transmission of information, newspaper, television, and radio will take the time more often to correct itself, but not information on the Internet. It does not correct itself.
Well, sometimes it does, most times it doesn't. A lot of times legitimate journals hide their boo-boos in the back pages in the small print, and the boo-boos are in the front page, so who knows? Ed, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, regarding that item I read, I believe it was the New York Times. It was either the Times or the Washington Post, the thing about 5G and the radar altimeters. It said radar altimeters go back to the 1920s. Considering that the most fundamental radar experiments didn't take place until 1935, and no one put any kind of a radar of any kind into an airplane until 1941, it's kind of hard to have a radar altimeter in an airplane in the 1920s. I assume somebody said altimeters, as in barometric altimeters, date back to the 1920s, and somehow they didn't quite understand the difference and just wrote it down.
Yeah, it sounds perfectly legitimate. I'm not saying that there's any conspiracy involved in the discussion of radio altimeters. It's just that a lot of people get a lot of things wrong. You know, some people are obsessive compulsive and they triple check, and others double check, and others barely single check. And there's the occasional one who just makes stuff up. Every so often, their career blows up and they are become their own pariahs. But yeah, I tend to believe in the concept that most people are not bad, but unfortunately a lot of people are just either lazy or incompetent, and it's not evil that causes the problems. It's just the laziness and incompetence.
Roy, it's not just the difference between laziness and incompetence or obsessive and compulsive. What happened to being more intelligent?
I have a comment on that. Roy, I lied to you the other day.
Heaven forfend, Edward. How did you lie to me?
If you remember that email I sent you that you were chuckling over, I said something that's not at all relevant to what I was saying, but I realized I got mixed up with another system I had worked on previously. So there was something technically wrong because they got two things mixed up. Like I said, it changes nothing in what I told you.
Oh, okay. Look, we all make mistakes. I would love to have a full-time copy editor to look over my shoulder and fix the comma mistakes and the spelling mistakes and the copy-paste mistakes. And, you know, I write articles for Limewire at times. Haven't done it in a while. I write a newsletter for another club, and I can't talk anyone into copy-proofing it. So, you know, sometimes I'll read old articles and I'll say, geez, how did I let that one go through? So, no harm, no foul.
Oh, I have something to tell you, and the net.
Okay, for the net, after the net, something else?
No, I was shanghaied into doing something. At the Limewire April meeting, I will be delivering a talk that is excerpted from that HRU presentation I made a few years ago that you liked.
Oh, great. I hope they record it and they put it into YouTube. The problem with the meetings, last time I checked, they're the first Wednesday of the month, because that's the same exact time that I have my other club's meeting, and I'm an actual officer there, so they take it personal if I don't show up.
I have on good authority it's the second Wednesday.
Question. Does anybody know when is the next Hamfest?
Is this the end of the month?
The 27th.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Thank you.
And it's at Levittown Hall, right?
QSL.
See you, Wesley. We help.
Thank you very much.
Okay, my other problem is on the second and fourth Wednesday, not that I'm advertising it here, but I, because I just can't control myself, I have a technical net on those days as well, on the Kings County Radio Club repeater, KC2RC, at 146.730. So most of my Wednesdays, I seem to have jobs to do.
Yeah, I have a similar problem. I have other meetings, and I have to skunk another group, the Boy Scouts, when I do my presentation.
Well, once again, I certainly hope that someone records it for posterity and puts it up on YouTube, because I would love to watch it.
Oh, never mind, John. I have a great story. Good question.
Okay, very good, Ed. By the way, someone else was doubling with you, but you were winning the contest.
That was probably me. Yeah, WS2N. They record everything. It will be on YouTube. No problem. The Limark YouTube channel.
Ah, very good. I look forward to it. So, Ed, you wanted to say something?
Oh, wait, I think I told you on that email, but I think the group, I think Paul would like this. I had a doctor's appointment. I'm sitting in the waiting room. Woman comes in. She's talking to the woman behind the desk. And it comes down. They then start comparing notes that they both had COVID, and their taste and smell have not come back yet. And then one says, although occasionally I get a smell of fire. And the other one says, yeah, me too, but I thought it was just me. Anyway, then this woman sits down near me. I said, excuse me. You said you smell fire. Do you mean like, you know, a fireplace? And she said, yeah, exactly. So then I went home and I realized, and now I'm very worried, because last Saturday, all day long, I just smelled fire and wood burning, and the fact that I was running a Boy Scout fire building competition couldn't possibly have anything to do with it.
Well, if we were doing Morse code tonight, I would say hi.
If we do Morse code, I'd ask to ensure that there's a new repeater ID on the Glen Oak site is under 20 words per minute.
That's a good question. I'm trying to think. It strikes me as just about 20 words per minute, if I remember the cadence and the speed of the signal, because I heard it tonight. So it sort of sounds like that to me.
I think it's a little faster, but I'm really not qualified to say. Although I'll tell you, it's an awful lot faster than it was. I mean, it's... The old one was like, you know, 12 words per minute, 13 words a minute. Now it's significantly faster and shorter. They dropped the L-I-N-Y. Right on order.
Talk of the devil.
Yeah, it used to be W2VL/R, then space, and L-I-N-Y. Now it's just W2VL, right to the point. No fooling around.
Roy, what antenna do you use?
For what?
For HF.
For HF, I have a Serio 2018 5/8 wave 10 meter, and I have a AE antenna fan dipole.
How does the fan work?
Well, sometimes better, sometimes not so good. It's not really great for 80. It uses a loading coil, so the Q is rather high, and the bandwidth is rather narrow, and there are some patches of 80 meters that I can't even tune it with my antenna tuner. So it's a decent compromise antenna. I'm sure guys out there in Florida and places that have 200-foot towers with phase array Yagis and such would laugh at it all, but it serves my purpose.
Did you think about anything that is vertical, dipole that I was talking about?
I'm not quite sure what you're alluding to. Like I said, my stereo, my 10-meter is a 5/8 vertical.
No, I understand, but from those that I was talking about today.
Oh, I haven't really been thinking in terms of new antennas. I'm trying to get old antennas slightly fixed. I'm not really a big fan of Sigma, again, because it's not well known. It's a small company, it's out of the country, and there are too many complaints of problems that it has. But don't really have that much space on my roof to put up much more than it already has.
You have a backyard. The 6B TV doesn't have to be on roof. 6B TV by Hustler, 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 75, and 80.
Well, I mean, it might be doable. If I put it down on the ground, I'd have to put a lot of radials, which the other people who live here probably are not going to be thrilled with. And also, you also have to figure out the topology of my environment is dubious for a vertical. Think in terms of two rows of connected two-family houses going from one end of the block to the other on either side. So doesn't really, you need a little elevation even with a vertical under those circumstances, I think.
Oh, Roy, you have a great metallic ground plane right near you.
Pray tell.
Although the Transit Authority might take a dim view of my ideas.
Oh, well, I'm actually two blocks away from the subway, so the wire, running that much wire there would probably cause other problems.
But just think of the grounding.
Yeah, but who knows? Those guys could drop a wrench someplace, and all of a sudden I got the track electricity going through there.
Have to have a big plate or a screen on the roof. Enter here.
Well, I don't know. I think that's kind of asking for even more problems. I got a lot of stuff stacked up on the roof, and it's not that easy to get to it. So I don't know. Right now I'm just trying to keep things working. My poor GP6, which was one of my major UHF-VHF antennas, just stopped working, and I don't know how I'm going to get that fixed. So I'm just trying to fix things instead of adding more things to the roof.
In my particular situation, I have two houses, one in front, one at the rear. So in the old days, I had a G5RTV between the houses. But now, because I have a flat roof, and you have a flat roof, if I remember correctly, right? A screwdriver antenna, what is it, 6 feet width? Less than that. And it's motorized, center XGN.
Yeah, and if anything gets stuck, then it's a big pain in the backside to get someone to go up there. Because even though it's flat, which is a very good thing, because I know people who have slopers, I don't have ready access to the roof from the inside. So someone has to drag out the 30-foot expandable ladder and jump up there and then jump over the sloping front veneer and do the work. And not surprising, that's very difficult to find someone who's interested in doing that.
Let me know when you're ready. For free. I do it all the time.
Okay, I will keep you in mind. Hopefully during the springtime, I'm going to try to arrange a little get-together and to at least fix my GP6, because I would like to have an extra UHF-VHF antenna, because if something goes boom and down, it's always nice to have an extra one. Right now, I'm using a GP3 that's on a laundry pole in the backyard for these conversations, and I have a small Yagi that's pointed directly at a 8-story co-op across the street, but happens to be in line with most repeaters that I need to access. Those are my only remaining UHF-VHF antennas. I think we should kind of move on to the SpaceNet report, because I feel as though Paul is just kind of sitting there waiting.
Paul, pick up.
No problem, Roy. I like listening to all these stories instead of listening to me. So it's very, very good. Very interesting. AC2GSWS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Okay, first I wanted to say there's a couple of cargo vehicles that went up to the space station last week. Monday night you had a launch of a Progress ship from Kazakhstan. Russia sent the Soyuz filled with 6,000 pounds, roughly 3 tons of stuff, to the space station, and they docked with it 2 days later. They docked with the Poisk module, one of the Russian modules that's on the zenith facing side of the space station. Dropped. Now, it's got all kinds of cargo in it, and it also has quite a bit of fuel. You know, they have the capability of refueling the space station to, they use their thrusters on what they call the Zvezda module, main Russian module, to push the space station forward to eventually change its elevation. You know, the elevation always degrades over time. You know, so the, normally, years ago, they used to dock with the Zvezda module first, and then, you know, leave it there and unpack everything and close the doors and eventually refuel it, and then the Progress would eventually depart. And now, anytime you needed to use the thrusters, they could ignite them. But they don't do that anymore. They don't dock with that module, that rear-facing module anymore. They dock with the other module, in this case, the Poisk. Now what they'll do is open up the hatch, unload everything, all the valuable stuff, you know, the science equipment, the food, the supplies, the vodka, whatever the Russians drink, I don't know. But they'll unload thousands of pounds of stuff into the space station that way. And then over time, they'll actually disconnect the Progress vehicle from that module, and then they will connect to the Zvezda module, and they will refuel at that time. The reason they don't use that anymore, they call the vestibule, the space between the outer, you know, the outer hatch where they connect, and the actual inside of the Zvezda module. That vestibule area, you know, there's a slight leak there, so they'd rather not leave that. So that's the reason they do that. So that was completed, and sure enough, yesterday, another launch from Wallops Island, Virginia, with the Antares rocket and the Cygnus spacecraft on top. This time loaded with a lot more tonnage, over 8,000 pounds, or a little over four tons of material going up to the space station on that will dock to the American side, or will dock to the Nadir port, the bottom port of the Unity module, and it actually berths to it. I'll have 16 bolts that will tighten down automatically. It'll take some time to do that, but after they dock tomorrow, it takes 2 days to put up together. They will do the same thing, unload everything into the space station. Now this time, they're doing something a little different with the Cygnus module. By the way, Cygnus is the 17th one to dock to the space station. They've been doing this for quite a few years now. They have they have it now in position. Once it's in position, they could actually rotate the space station. The control moment gyros, four big gyros on the space station will turn on, and it will rotate the whole space station. Probably about 90 degrees, and then it would also have to yaw a little bit. Then they will be able to fire the thrusters on the Cygnus module. So it's the first time the Cygnus will be used to actually accelerate the space station to actually change its elevation, bring it up a few miles. I think it only changes about 2 miles an hour or so, 2 to 3 miles an hour, but that's enough to increase its altitude. And they do this every time they get a chance because, being in space, it's 250 miles up, sure, but it's very rarefied, but that doesn't mean there's no molecules up there. There are, molecules floating around that tend to slow down the space station over time. If it was up 500 miles or 1,000 miles, it might take, a couple hundred years for the space station to come back down. But where it is now, if there was no firing of thrusters to increase the speed, eventually it could decay. I think I read three to four years it would start to slow down to the point where they would start to get worried about it. That's with no reboost system. Any comments, questions? WS2M. Okay. Nothing heard. So crappy noise on my speaker, that's odd. Okay, my Icon 2600 is still working good. Once in a while, it starts to make weird noise. Probably tomorrow I'm getting into the speaker. Anyway, today is February 20th, and believe it or not, it's 60 years since John Glenn made his orbital flight. Three orbits and then returning safely to the Atlantic Ocean. So anybody who was around, I think most of us were, might remember that happening, and that was, of course, a very big deal. I followed two suborbital flights by Shepard and Britton, and then they were 15-minute flights straight up, maybe go 108 miles up or so, and then come back down in the Atlantic Ocean. And then they went with John Glenn, instead of using the Redstone rocket, which was underpowered for orbital flight, they used the Atlas LV-3B is what it was called, an Atlas C rocket. And they put John Glenn on top of it. It's around 100 feet tall. I think it was 94 feet tall. And you compare that to, let's say, the Falcon 9, which is 220 feet tall. It gives you an idea. But this is only 10 feet in diameter. Falcon 9, I think, is 12 feet in diameter. But you have a total boost pressure of almost 400,000 pounds with this Atlas vehicle. Compare that again to the Falcon 9, since that's the most common one that's going up, and that's a little over 2 million pounds of thrust. So they launched from Mach Complex 14. That's like almost 50 different Mach complexes. That's not quite, but almost that amount down in Florida. And they used number 14. It was used throughout the Mercury missions, so you had four Mercury orbital missions that left left from lunch, complex 14. And eventually, that same launch complex was used to launch the Agena rockets into space, which NASA used to dock with the first Gemini missions. But after Agena was finished, that's it. They closed Launch Complex 14 now forever, and then they more or less made it a visiting site. You know, they put a plaque there, and since everything was rusting, they took everything away. So there's a plaque, and then there's a time capsule that's supposed to be open like 500 years after the launch, so I don't think we're going to be around to watch the time capsule open. But John Glenn, he did pretty good up there. He was supposed to go for 7 orbits, but they cut that short. He started to use more fuel than they figured on. Plus, they saw some problems with there was a signal light telemetry that came back to mission control. Mercury control back then is what they called it. And the light indicated that that maybe the heat shield was starting to come loose. So the Mercury spacecraft, to slow down to deorbit, they had retro rockets, 3 of them on the back of the, attached with straps at the back of the heat shield. We had the heat shield and then these 3 rockets that were strapped on. And the idea was to slow the vehicle down. These rockets would fire, and then you would slow down enough to start to deorbit. Before you did that, you would get rid of the retro rocket pack that would disconnect, and then the heat shield would be going down first. So they radioed to John Glenn, make sure you don't disconnect the pack. They felt, well, if the heat shield is loose, these cables, these straps will, you know, by not disconnecting the retro rockets, that will help keep the shield on. And they left that, like, you know, pretty much all the way through the ionization, you know, when the heat shield heats up and they need to, right at that point, they did try to get rid of the, they didn't need it anymore. But it pretty much burnt up anyway as it was coming through the atmosphere. So he got back safely. They eventually figured out that it was a false sensor. So there was nothing wrong. The heat shield was never loose in the first place. Wondering if I timed out here. WS2N. Are you copying me?
Yes, you're coming across fine.
Okay, that's odd. Very good. I unkeyed and I didn't hear the courtesy tone coming back or anything. Anyway, John Glenn, of course, isn't with us anymore. We all know that he became a senator as time went on. His wife lived with him all those years, and eventually she died actually of COVID a year and a half ago. I think she made it to 100 years old. He had quite a life. Military pilot, and test pilot and all, and you know, then he got a second chance to go into space. They didn't want him to go back up anymore. They figured, we have a hero here. We don't want to send him up and wind up in a space accident and lose a hero. So they wouldn't let him fly anymore. And eventually he talked his way into it. He got to fly on a shuttle mission back in 1990. There was six other astronauts at the time. And he enjoyed that, of course. At that time, he was the oldest person to actually fly on a space shuttle and into orbit. Okay, another thing I wanted to just talk about in the news, they kept talking about Falcon 9 second stage booster. You know, second stage, the Falcon 9 has the Merlin engine, and this thing would produce normally 200 pounds of thrust. And they claim the news, like Ed said, you know, one news guy picks it up, and another station picks it up, and it goes like the game of telephone, and they all picked up the same story, thinking that the second stage from a Falcon 9 rocket that launched Discover, Discover's satellite that they did launch back in 2015. Spacecraft wound up going to the L1 position, 1 million miles away from Earth, but toward the sun, and it works today too. It's detecting all the rays from the sun, you know, the X-rays and wind velocity, the solar wind, and all of that. Very successful mission. But the second stage, they said, kept orbiting. It would go around the moon, eventually around Earth, and come back around the moon. And the prediction was that this second stage was going to crash into the far side of the moon. And, you know, naturally the story goes that, you know, SpaceX maybe didn't know what they were doing, or they should have had a different kind of second stage booster. We're going to litter the moon with stuff. Not that it matters. We've crashed so much. You know, we as humans have crashed a lot of stuff into the moon. Into the moon over the years, but, you know, they picked it up as, you know, we're trashing the moon.
WB2EAV.
Okay, and I hear you. And then, of course, right now, that story has changed. It's 100%. It's now a Chinese second stage boost. Back to you, Ed.
No, this is not where you think I'm going. Did they use the term Merlin engine? The term Merlin engine has a history. It was a B-16 World War II aircraft engine used on multiple planes, and like they retire hurricane names when they're a big deal, I think they should retire the Merlin engine term.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, he gets, you know, this is Elon Musk. So he names his Falcon rocket. You know, he calls the crew base vehicle and the cargo vehicle the Dragon. So he got that from science fiction. And then he picked up Merlin. I guess that you know, they use that name a lot. And then, you know, the magician and all. And he picked up on that. He's got all his names named after science fiction things. His floating boats, these autonomous ships at sea. One is named, just read the instructions. That's the name of it. And it comes from some science fiction book that I didn't read. And the other one, is called Of Course I Still Love You. And that's the other name of the ship. Now he's got a new one. And he names these things after these science fiction movies, and so that's where he got the name Merlin from. Yeah, they're all those on the Falcon 9. All those nine engines are Merlin engines. They had Merlin A engines, Merlin C. These are all Merlin D engines. You know, A, B, C, D. Each one is more advanced. Each one puts out more thrust. And of course, the second stage, he just has the one. So he gets over 200,000 pounds of thrust in a vacuum. So you want them to retire that name? It's not going to happen. Back to you, Ed.
I'm just saying, the Merlin engine is very famous. It's the only airplane engine that lasted the entire duration of World War II. The Spitfires used them in the Battle of Britain. At the end of the war, the P-51s used it. Anything in between, they used them in some multi-engine bombers.
Okay. I didn't know. And, well, they never retired them. So they were all made for the pieces. Well, that means they were made here. Well, let's see. Where were the engines made? They might have been assembled here on the island for P-51s. Didn't Grumman make them?
Grumman didn't make the P-51 Mustang. I'm not sure which company, North American, I think they were California-based. But the point I'm saying is, it was the original 1940 Spitfire design, just upgraded and tweaked a little bit and built here.
Very good. Okay. Now, his new rocket, the Starship, he's calling those the Raptor engines, you know. In fact, he's already up to the second iteration of Raptors. So maybe the Raptor is a better name, you know, for his new engine. Maybe he's not going to infringe on anybody's copyrights with that one. What do you think?
Oh, I'm all for it.
Very good. And he's pushing twice the amount of thrust out of the Raptors as he's getting out of the Merlins. Merlins are around 200. It's already, like I said, over 400. And he's got dreams of upping that number to closer to 500,000 pounds of thrust. That should put 33 of those engines on the back of a booster. That's what he plans on doing for Starship. And then he's going to have, it used to be six, and now it's going to be nine Raptor engines on the second stage. So he's got 33 on the booster, nine on the second stage. And the first one, you know, will not be reusable. He's going to dump the booster into the Gulf of Mexico, and the Starship is going to take a dive into the water near Hawaii. So he better start mass producing these things fast. You know, maybe he'll turn them out like he's turning out Tesla cars or something. So, I don't know. Anyway, I just want to get through at least one more topic here. This WS-2. The this one guy, Jared Isaacman, he is the billionaire that paid Elon Musk hundreds of millions of dollars to launch himself and three others to the to nowhere. They flew for 3 days in space in orbit and came back and successfully landed, splashed down, and then he had a SpaceX ship pick him up. And, you know, it was all private. NASA had nothing to do with it. It was all, you know, all this guy's money, and people that donated money, they were trying to raise hundreds of millions of dollars for the St. Jude Hospital, which I thought was great. And apparently he got that far, and then he was short, I think, I don't know, $50 million or something, and Elon Musk said, no problem. I'll add that to it. You know, they were pretty much promising them that. I think they wound up with $250 million for the hospital. Anyway, this guy is, he wants to go up again. So he's ordering three more flights. He's going to call these the Polaris mission. That's the name Polaris. With these commercial flights. He's going to go up with three other people this December. Two women and another guy. One of the women, Sarah, I forget her last name, she trained the four people that went up. She was in charge of training astronauts for SpaceX. And if you see on Netflix the documentary, they had a couple of three or four in the series. Anyway, this one person that trained them was Sarah. And sure enough, she's going to be one of the people that go. She was training them, and now she's actually going to go. That will be in December. And then he plans on two more after that.